The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Book of Serenity, Case 99, Yunmen's Bowl and Bucket. There's a particular knowledge for chess, a particular stomach for wine, the three holes of a crafty rabbit, the myriad raids of a wily fox. There is still another uninhibited one. Tell me, who is this? A student asked Master Yunmen, what is every atom samadhi? Yunmen said, rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. Hongzhe's verse. Rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. Opening his mouth, he shows his guts, seeking one who knows themself. Try to think and you fall into second and third impulses. Face to face suddenly becomes 10 million miles. Master Yunmen realized a little bit. The metal cutting meaning. Who is the same? The mind, firmer than rock, alone can be like this. I don't know that we generally think of Zazen, of our meditation practice, as something in which we're developing skills. Although we think of many things like that. Develop playing an instrument, a sport, a language, developing our skills, particular knowledge for chess, particular stomach for wine. Is there a skill that we are developing to enlighten our mind, to open our heart? There's so much emphasis in Mahayana Buddhism on intention, raising aspiration. We'll be focusing a lot on that in this ongoing, the Bodhisattva path, bodhicitta. And as powerful as those are, they're not enough. We actually have to practice, to develop, and to say, you could say we develop our skills in sitting, in just being, in being utterly. Every action involves a particular mind, a body, a meeting, a responding, a seeing. You know, practice can be difficult sometimes. And in that way, it can seem like we're doing something unnatural, right? If practice was just coming completely into accord with our basic nature, then why wouldn't it just be easy all the way through? Like he says in the poem, try to think and we fall into second and third impulses, and just being face to face, just being, suddenly becomes 10 million miles. Sometimes people practicing the breath come in and say, I can't find it. I say, well, if you really lose it, you'll pass out and you'll find it again. That doesn't really happen. And so our attachments bind, constrict, tether. I remember in the early teachings of the Abhidharma, the teachings of the mental factors, it says that attachments have a function. And their function is to give rise to dissatisfaction. That in our very grasping, in order to get, accomplish, achieve, arrive, that very action gives rise to our dissatisfaction. That's its function. That's saying it pretty clearly. And so to develop a particular knowledge for sitting, which begins with instruction, but it doesn't stay there long. It's something much more direct. And then sitting, Zazen, we find out, includes a kind of a village of qualities, aspects, skills, you could say. Attention, alertness, mindfulness, concentration. Virtues that come along with that, patience, trust, faith. And you could say every aspect of being able to see clearly, being able to let go, being able to examine, investigate, all to arrive at the discovery of this uninhibited one, free of self-consciousness, contrivance. Who is it? The pointer asks, who is this person? And so when we begin practicing, we direct our attention, which is our, in this case, our awareness, to the breath. So the mind engages with the breath. And that what the Buddha made so clear for our great benefit is that that is embedded within a path. And in that path, necessarily, that what's required, and not because the Buddha said so, although he did, but because this is actually what's required in order for this to come to fruition. That practice of sitting is taking place within a life in which we are cultivating compassion, in which we are trying to not burn the house down again, and not burn anybody else's house down. In other words, to cease from causing harm. And more than that, to actually do some good. Do a whole heap of good at every chance we get. And that in that, then there is our attention, our concentration, our mindfulness, those virtuous qualities that we're developing, and that the Buddha said all of that leads to concentration, facilitates, makes easier, in certain ways possible. And that leads to our insight, our realization, which is what ultimately transforms our life. And so mindfulness is described as that mental factor that prevents the mind from forgetting the familiar thing. So when you're practicing the breath is the familiar thing, the thing you're trying to make very familiar, that you keep coming back to. And mindfulness is to not forget that. And that the function of mindfulness is to prevent movement of the mind away from that thing which we are not forgetting. This morning before caretaking, I talked a little bit about how we get hooked. I said tricked by movement, right? The slightest thing can set our minds off to wandering, to moving away from the familiar thing. I think every meditator has experienced that. And so the function of mindfulness is to prevent that, to stabilize that, to begin to give us back, to reclaim our mind, right? Because without mindfulness, in a way, we're just a little out of control, right? The mind's a little out of control, right? So when we're sitting, we see that. And when we try and control, respond to that, out of control by controlling, well, that just doesn't go so well. And that leads to concentration. And it's important to appreciate that not every teachers have different, throughout the ages and different lineages and traditions, see the relationship between these different factors, between mindfulness and concentration, between concentration and thought, between the non-conceptual and conceptual mind. There's not a complete sort of uniformity of view on this. And I think that arises directly out of different people's, different teachers' actual experiences, both within themselves and within the people that they teach. And so they're not only studying their own mind, but they're studying the minds of every person that comes before them, seeking the Dharma. But the Buddha taught this way, and generally it's acknowledged that there is clearly a relationship. It's not necessarily a requisite relationship, or that there has to be a requisite amount of this in order for that, that in order for this. But generally speaking, or perhaps more than generally speaking, more sort of more, that mindfulness leads to concentration, and concentration is single-pointedness of mind placed on the thing that in mindfulness we are not forgetting, so that it can be investigated, so that it can be examined. That thing, that breath, that koan, that sensation, that awareness, that emotion. And that investigation itself is taught in different ways in terms of how that is to be undertaken. But the function of the investigation is to see beyond its appearance. Because all of those things that arise, they're to some degree familiar. Oh, it's my breath. Oh, it's a sensation. Oh, it's pain. Oh, it's an emotion. Right? It doesn't seem new. In fact, that's the thing. It doesn't seem new. And there are ways in which we aren't yet seeing it. And so there's investigation. And that is spoken of as it functions as the basis of wisdom. And that the sort of etymology of concentration is to apprehend correctly, to see things correctly, that is, as they are. And it's not apprehending as in apprehending a thief. It's apprehending as in making direct contact with, seeing clearly, knowing without understanding, understanding without knowing. And those early teachings go on to say that the cause of concentration is physical solitude away from social involvement, that is, away from gatherings of many people. So we have a few people here, but it's not a social gathering, right? We're in silence. We keep our eyes lowered, right? And in that way, we create a sense of solitude. It's not necessarily physical solitude, which is a good thing, and a good thing to practice and try and incorporate into one's practice when one can, but a sort of a mental kind of solitude. That we're not engaging each other socially, right? That happens when we lift the silence. So that's one cause of concentration that helps us to develop our concentration. And the other is mental solitude free from gross conceptualization. That is, free from running after various objects of thought. And so you see the connection between that and mindfulness. Mindfulness is not forgetting that thing which is familiar, and is to become so familiar through its investigation that we realize it. And so by placing the mind on the object, mindfulness does not forget that object. That's its definition. And then our diligence, another quality that we're cultivating, places the mind on that object again and again. When we forget. So this is just a different way of saying what you already know, right? What everybody, each of us received when we first received instructions on Zen. Returning to the breath, for instance, is placing the mind again, which is our attention, on the breath, that object, that familiar thing. And so it's that placement of the mind, again and again, and being diligent, right? Which means we have to keep doing it. So to be diligent is to do that, to persevere, to be patient. And then it goes on to say that what happens with this concentration is that in reliance on it, as it develops, gets stronger, the wisdom of special insight arises. We begin to see things more clearly as they are, a more penetrating insight beyond what we can know with our thinking mind, by just perceiving things as they appear. And in this, it also pacifies, calms the mental disturbances, the kleshas, the strong, overwhelming emotions, the tenacious opinions and views that we get so bound up in, that come from our attachment, whose function is our dissatisfaction, and causes excitation, agitation, a scattering, and gross fluctuations of thoughts, right? Just the restless mind. And in this way, it helps to make the mind and body serviceable. Kind of a lovely, simple, curious way of describing it. Makes the body and mind serviceable. May I be of service? I would love to, but I can't because I'm so caught up. Because I'm attached, I'm making myself dissatisfied, because I'm excited, and not in a positive way, but in an agitated way, because I'm scattered. So I would love to be of service to you, but I'm going to have to get back to you on that. Not right now. It actually says, and so it makes the mind and body serviceable, and so on. And so on. And then it makes clear that concentration is not the same as attention. Attention directs the mind to its object, but it doesn't by its own power give rise to wisdom. You know, so to appreciate that, you know, Buddhism has so profoundly and deeply studied what we're doing, sitting. So when we talk about sitting, zazen, meditation, lots of people meditate. I meditate. Oh, do you meditate? Oh, great. We both meditate. Right? What do you do in your meditation? Oh, this is what I do in my meditation. All of that is true, but in Buddhism, it has all of this depth, and we might say nuance, almost a kind of complexity, not in being complicated, but in terms of being of this web, this intricacy of your mind, of my mind, of consciousness, what the Buddha called the world. And all of these different factors, these different elements, right? And the teachings here are that when we understand this more, then we can be more aware of these different elements as they're being cultivated, or not, as they're being strengthened, as they're coming more into helping us be serviceable, or not. In other words, it helps us to guide ourselves so that we're not reducing this really profound body of wisdom that has come down to us in what we call sitting Zen, sitting meditation, to just being mindful and think of that in a very two-dimensional way. We're developing our concentration or calming down or any of the different elements which are part of it. But what makes each of these aspects powerful is that they're interweaving with all of these other aspects and working together to make us serviceable. So think of when you're sitting and it's difficult, you're restless, the energy's all bound up, there's tension, your mind is, you know, or it's just, right? We might not think of it that way, but it's like, you know, to be serviceable means to be able to respond. How can I help? How can I help? And we know what we want to do, but it's hard to actually do that. We can hear and study these and think, yeah, that's exactly what I want to be cultivating, but it can be hard to actually do that, right? We're not yet able to really respond within to meet ourselves, to have those be fully serviceable. So that's what we call practice. And so these are traditional ways of talking about samadhi, concentration, mindfulness, and so on, and how they interrelate, which is just marvelous. But Yunmen is not doing that. You might have noticed. What is every atom samadhi, the student asks, and Yunmen says, rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. He didn't say anything about mindfulness or attention or concentration or do this with your legs, your body, attachments, letting go. He didn't say anything. Rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. He wants you and me to enter directly, completely. What is every atom samadhi? The footnote to that says, I make a vow to not scatter sand. I make a vow to not scatter sand. If you've ever been on a beach or any kind of surface where there's a lot of sand and then the wind starts to blow, gets in your eyes, gets in your nose, the harder it blows, the harder it is to actually breathe. Blinds us, makes things uncomfortable. I vow to not scatter sand. In the commentary, quotes the Avatamsaka Sutra and says that it speaks of entering right samadhi on one atom and rising from right samadhi on all atoms. When we enter in the state of concentration, ultimately, you have to go alone. In fact, you can't even go with. You can't even come. You can't take yourself with you. Not even the self can come. Just one atom. But when you rise, you take everybody with you. The multitude. Move among them and intermingle. So, we could just at the beginning of session say, instead of, we could dispense with precautions, opening words, and just say, we're beginning session, rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. See you on Sunday. So what is this practice? How do we practice? Because Yunmen is not talking about practice. And this is very characteristic, both of Yunmen's teaching, many teachers within the Zen tradition, is presenting you with a living thing. It's not practice this, so settle, you start with your breath, yeah, your mind's going to be restless, you're going to develop your mindfulness, this is what mindfulness means, you're going to get frustrated, so be patient, you're going to have doubts, so have faith, which all is important, essential, extremely helpful, all the way through. But Yunmen is giving you the thing itself. There's a sutra, the Suringama Sutra, which is an important sutra in the Mahayana, part of our own tradition. He says, in which the Buddha he's giving a talk, and he takes a piece of cloth, and he ties it into a knot. And then he shows it to Ananda and says, what is this? And Ananda said, it's a knot. And then he ties another knot. And he says, what is this? And Ananda said, it's another knot. And then he ties four more. And then the Buddha says, these six knots are different, but all come from one length of cloth. It is the same with your six sense organs. Remember that in Buddhism, the mind is one of the sense organs. The object of that sense organ is the activity of your mind, thoughts, concepts, and so on. So he says they're different, but they all come from one length of cloth, and it is the same with your sense organs, which, though coming from the same source, are manifestly different. And it's because of confusion in the mind, he actually says, in your mad mind, wild mind, that since the beginning of time, the intellect gives rise to illusions and the unceasing creation of that which disturbs one's seeing and causes it to perceive objects in the same way that troubled eyes see dancing flowers. You come across this a lot. It's a kind of a metaphor for delusion, that if a person has cataracts, for instance, that they see things that they see, but somebody without cataracts doesn't see. And both are true. The person with cataracts sees them, and so they have a reality for that person. But it's due to this condition of their eyes. And if that condition were healed, then they would no longer see them. And so Ananda says, well, how can one untie these knots that are caused by trouble and confusion? So the Buddha takes up the piece of cloth and he pulls it from one side and asks Ananda, can it be untied this way? And Ananda says, no. And then he pulls it from the other side and says, what about that? And Ananda says, no, it doesn't work. The Buddha says, I've pulled it from both ends of the cloth, but have been unable to untie the knots. What will you do now? And Ananda said, each knot has to be untied from its center, from its heart. The Buddha said, correct. A knot should be untied from within its heart. Therefore, Ananda, choose one sense organ from among the six, and if the knot in that sense organ is untied, then all the objects of sense will vanish of themselves, will be untied as well. All the dissatisfaction, the disappointment, the suffering that arises through that sense organ will be liberated. The Buddha said, when you begin to disentangle them, you'll realize that the self is empty. And when this emptiness is perfectly clear, you'll realize that all phenomena are this way. And when you are disengaged from the Dharma, in other words, there's no attachment, it's all realized in its true nature, then the emptiness of things will also disappear. This is called the patient endurance of the uncreated, achieved by means of samadhi on the bodhisattva path. So to think about this then in sitting, where something arises, right? A thought, a sound, something that you see, something that you feel, and it's knotted. And you turn your attention and go to the center of that to untie that knot. Each and all the subjective and objective spheres are related and at the same time independent. The senses are related. It's one person, one mind, one consciousness. But at the same time, they're independent, related yet working differently. And though each keeps its own place, right? The eyes don't smell. The ears don't taste. Even though they each keep their own place, form makes the character and appearance different. They show up differently, even though they have the same nature. And so sounds distinguish comfort and discomfort. The four elements return to their nature. Fire is hot, wind moves, water is wet, earth hard, eyes see, ears hear, nose smells, tongue tastes the salt and sour. Each is independent and related. you know, it's kind of like when there's a lot going in our lives, several different things going in our lives, and each one has its own trouble spot. That we can conflate them in our mind and turn them into what the Buddha might have called a great mass of suffering. It's like just one whole thing. But it's not. When we look, we see that this is a situation. This is a relationship that needs attention. Over here, there's something going on at work. Over here, there's something going on with my health. They're related, but they're working, but they at the same time, they're independent. They each have their own appearance and need their own attention. And so how do we disentangle the knot? Well, we can't just pull at it. That's why the analogy of a knot is so good, right? Because if you get a knot, you know, it's like a piece of rope. Like sometime I'm taking my belt off of the hook in the Dokusan room, and I'm trying to put it on, and the ends have just wrapped themselves around each other, right? They've just twirled themselves around just due to the weight of gravity. And I guess they like each other. They're saying hello. And if I pull at them, it'll actually create a knot that I create. And the more I pull it, because it's like, well, there isn't a knot there. So I pull at it, and it actually gets tighter. And oftentimes, all you have to do is just shake it, and they'll come undone. So it's such a nice sort of analogy for ourselves, what we do. And then if we pull from one side, well, I'm just going to avoid this, this sucks, I don't want this, make it go away. Or if on the other side, I pull from the other end, I love this, I'm going to hang on to this one. Don't go away. It gets tighter. It has to be untied from its heart, untied from its heart, from the center. It has to be untied authentically. It has to be untied in accord with the nature of the knot itself. That's why I said this morning that if we, you know, if we meet our frustration with more frustration, that's pulling at one end. If we meet our judging mind with more judgment, that's pulling on the other end. It just gets tighter. And yet it seems so natural, right? That's the impulse. The impulse is to meet it in kind, meet it in the same way, because it's that very impulse that brought it forth in the first place. So we've already got that going. We're practicing that, so we just meet it in the same way, not consciously, of course, usually not intentionally. That's the habit. And so it can seem very counterintuitive to meet something that's actually causing us discomfort or pain with patience, with kindness. And as that knot is being loosened, what is actually being untied? Master Daojin asked Sinsan, the author of The Faith Mind, I beg your compassion, show me a way of liberation. And Sinsan said, well, who's binding you? And Daojin said, no one is binding me. So Sinsan said, then why are you seeking liberation? Are we just disentangling ourselves from the idea that we are entangled? What is liberation from the knot? Yunmen says, rice in the bowl, water in the bucket. The footnote says, it bumps the head, knocks the forehead, strikes the jowls, and hits the face. It's everywhere. He's speaking from within. From within, rice in the bowl. This is how it is. It hits you in the face, knocks you on the head. It's everywhere. If all of dukkha arises from the sense, the reified, solidified, invested state of separation and distance, How do we dissolve that? And that's the knot. How do we untie that knot? The clinging mind is a dividing mind. That's its function. A universe of separate bodies standing alone, separate. But think of a woodland. Standing back, being in the midst. You see these different trees. Here's an oak, here's a beech, here's a young one, here's an old one, here's a healthy one, here's an ailing one, here's a dead one, here's a sprouting one. Are they struggling with each other? Very often in reading, particularly, I'm still seeing it in writers about who are talking about trees, scientists who talk about trees. They talk about how the trees are fighting each other for sunlight and water and nutriments. And they actually use that language, are fighting for, fighting each other. Are they? Yes, each needs sunlight. Each needs what it needs, the conditions in order to live. Otherwise, it won't. It won't survive. Are they fighting? Are some of the trees winning and some losing? Are some superior and some inferior? Are some trees just more tree than others? Dogen said, "Let go of the self for the sake of the Dharma, without knowing how many times you do so." Don't count. Don't keep track. You seek the Dharma for the sake of the self without knowing in how many billions of eons you have done so. This is the vital activity of studying with a teacher, of studying the Dharma. This is the activity of practicing the self and following the self. How many thousands, millions, billions of times have you returned to that familiar thing? Have you wandered and forgotten? When we get lost, we can just get more lost. But getting lost can also be a way of how we develop our skills for finding our way back. An important element is don't panic. Don't panic. Master Yunmen realized a little bit, the poem says. The metal cutting meaning. Who is the same? It's like the Vajra, the diamond. The Diamond Sutra, the Vajra cutting sutra, diamond cuts through. That this metal is so strong, so sharp that it cuts through metal itself. Who is like this? The footnote says, if one does not turn against people in the heart, this metal cunning meaning, your wisdom, your better nature, your understanding, if we do not turn against people in the heart, the last line of the poem is, the mind firmer than rock alone can be like this, like a diamond. The mind firmer than rock alone can be like this. And the beautiful thing about that mind that has that strength, that stability, that incisiveness, is that what allows it to be like that is that it is pliant. The grasping mind is not, right? That's why it's so hard to shift. It's not pliant. But this that arises out of mindfulness, with our attention, with our concentration, with our insight, becomes very, very pliant. Because we realize there is nothing that is solid like that. If one does not turn against people in the heart, there will be no color of shame on the face. When we come face to face, suddenly, no longer 10 million miles, no longer hair's breadth difference or distance. And so let's appreciate that as we're sitting, each in our own way, in our own practice, in our own place on this path, facing our own minds, that we are sitting in the midst of this jewel. You know, I've said many times that when I first encountered the Dharma, I had the sense, I couldn't have articulated at that point, but I had the sense, which is what I felt so strongly, that this teaching that I was encountering understood me somehow, more than I understood me, knew something about me that I didn't know, was speaking to something in me that I was desperate to be a part of and hear and be able to respond. I was 10 million miles away, but starting to turn in the right in the direction of home. Face to face suddenly becomes face to face.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.